Gender and sexual orientation can make a difference in how medical professionals treat you. They should, you might think. For one thing, the parts of men and women are different. But research out of Portland shows that some doctors do not recognize how gender identification and sexual orientation can affect health outcomes. This is especially true in the field of neurology, as demonstrated by our guest and recently published research. Holly Hinson is an MD and an associate professor of neurology at the OHSU School of Medicine, Oregon Health and Science University in Portland. Thank you so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange, Dr. Hinson.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into your latest research, can you give us an overview of some of the research you've done generally in the same field?
Sure. So we're just beginning to understand how LGBTQ identity or sexual and gender minority identity intersect with neurology. So this field is quite young, and in fact, there hasn't been very much research in this area up until this point.
And so what are some of your basic findings so far? Is healthcare somewhat lacking, do you think, for LGBTQ people?
I think that we're just, as I mentioned, beginning to understand this. We know generally that that there is twice the all-cause mortality for sexual and gender minorities with compared with their heterosexual peers. But we don't have very much research specifically in subspecialty areas. Most of the research up until this time has been done in the primary care setting and not within medical specialties, of which, of course, neurology is one.
When you say, what was that figure, twice all-cause mortality? So mortality from all causes you're talking about?
That's correct, exactly. And so not one specific cause like heart disease or cancer, but broadly, all-cause mortality is about twice for this population. And it's one of the reasons that the NIH designated sexual and gender minorities as a population worthy of disparities research.
And did NIH put some funding into that too?
They have actually, yes. That designation was just made in 2016, and so it's quite recent. And we have not, unfortunately, yet had the time with that additional attention and funding to really make a lot of progress, but it's really optimistic that I think folks are really understanding the importance of understanding why these healthcare disparities exist. And other research has shown that clinical behavior by clinicians can, unfortunately, inadvertently contribute to some of these healthcare disparities. And that's a big reason why we were motivated to understand the attitudes and knowledge base of neurologists that are caring for sexual and gender minorities.
But just in general, before we get into the neurological part of this, I want to keep exploring this this twice all-cause mortality, because that double figure seems like it certainly shocks me. I don't know if it shocks anybody else.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's something that that the Cochrane Review actually put out in the last couple of years, and I think it was surprising to many researchers learning that indeed the statistics were so dramatic. And I think it really highlights the importance of digging into this field and really trying to unpack and understand how sexual and gender minority orientation or identification directly impacts health status.
So when we use the term SGM and sexual and gender minority, is it essentially the same as LGBTQ or LGBTQI?
Sure, that's a great question. And so the reason that we oftentimes say sexual and gender minorities is that it's a little bit more inclusive. As you know, the acronym has gotten more and more lengthy, and the intent is really to encompass as many identities within that spectrum as possible, because not everybody who falls into this arena feels comfortable with labels such as lesbian or gay or even bisexual or transgender. There's a great number of identities, and so we want to be as inclusive as possible when we're talking about this patient population.
I can see where we've continued to add initials to LGBT, LGBTQ, and so forth. So SGMs, you're saying it's a much broader general kind of category.
That's correct, exactly. And you had mentioned a moment ago trying to speculate about what maybe would motivate some of the increases in mortality in this patient population. We know some broad and general things, such as smoking status was a little bit higher in this patient population. We also know from the literature that minority stress can certainly impact just general health and well-being. And so these are the types of facets and areas that need to be explored further with high-quality research.
All right, so at the outset, it's hard to say whether the disparities in outcomes are caused by bias or misunderstanding of needs or some mixture thereof.
I think it's probably a very complex problem with a lot of different aspects to it. And I think it will take a lot of, as I mentioned, very careful research to start to unpack this. But we need to start somewhere. And so I'm very encouraged that NIH has recognized this patient population as worthy of study.
Holly Hinson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a physician, associate professor of neurology at the OHSU School of Medicine. We're talking about research into gender identification, sexual orientation, or SGM, sexual gender minority people, and neurological illnesses is where we're heading. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you've made some moves already in the field of neurology, I understand, to step up on behalf of sexual and gender minority people. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. And so a couple of things that we've done within our professional society. So I'm a member of the American Academy of Neurology, which is the largest professional organization of U.S. and North American neurologists. And within that society, again, to highlight some of these healthcare disparities and to try to understand and encourage more research, we created a section within the society itself for neurologists that are interested in this patient population, learning more, and then also neurologists that they themselves identify as somewhere in the sexual and gender minority umbrella, to have a way of which that they were able to network with one another. And so it really serves many purposes. And it's one of the very few sections of its kind within a professional organization. There are very few similar sections within different healthcare specialties.
And there are some particular concerns about neurology and sexual gender minority people. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's something that many neurologists are not necessarily aware of, that there are direct ways in which identification as a sexual or gender minority can directly impact a neurologic disease. And it can happen in many different facets. And so specifically, elder LGBTQI patients experience more poverty than their straight counterparts and may be discriminated against at rehabilitation facilities or assisted living. Additionally, historically, some of our antiretroviral therapies that combat HIV can be associated with neuropathy. And then gender-affirming hormone treatments can alter the levels of anti-epileptic drugs, which, if you're not familiar with that as an epileptologist, you might not understand why, for example, a patient's seizure frequency is suddenly increased when they might be going through a gender transition. And so those are just three aspects of and direct ways in which having a patient that identifies as somewhere in the LGBTQI spectrum can very directly impact their neurologic health and well-being.
The medication one is one that certainly jumps out, and maybe it's just because it's the easiest one to latch onto as a direct cause of further issues. So you're saying that the anti-seizure medication conflicts with the or combines poorly with the gender-affirming medication?
Not uniformly across the board, but very specifically, estrogen can impact the levels of very common anti-epileptic drugs. Dilantin is one good example, but there are many others. And it's just important for the healthcare professional to understand that there are interactions. It's not something that they themselves need to have memorized necessarily, but just an awareness that there are interactions can really improve the care. And there are ways in which that gender-affirming hormones can be continued. And again, that's critical therapy for this patient population without sacrificing other critical medical issues such as seizure control. So it just takes that kind of awareness and that creativity, which is critical for providing really high quality neurologic health care for this patient population.
So your recent research, you scattered, it looks like, 1,000 surveys to neurologists across the country, and I'm curious to know, before we find out how many returned them and what the results were, you knew in advance about things like the interaction we were just talking about, estrogen versus Dilantin, for example, right?
Yes, that's correct, but that's because I have a special interest in this area, and we know actually from the literature, and I can say anecdotally from my own experience, that the education for physicians is at least historically really poor in this area. And so very few medical schools, although that's changing dramatically, fortunately, have cultural competency education programs to educate rising physicians about some of these issues. I myself, when I was in medical school, I have to say now about 15 years ago, was not, I didn't have any type of programming in this arena. So this was something that I had to learn about on my own as a practicing physician later on. And we wondered if that was that impacted the ability of neurologists just generally to provide high quality neurologic health care. It was because of lack of really training or expertise in this area that's not part of a standard either medical school curriculum or part of neurology residency.
We're talking about medicine colliding with sexual and gender minority identity. And Dr. Holly Hinson's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Associate Professor of Neurology at OHSU, the Oregon Health and Science University School of Medicine. Questions and comments from you, welcome here on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's get to the recent research. 1,000 surveys across the country. Were you hoping to get back more than 13.5%?
We were indeed. Unfortunately, survey research oftentimes yields lower returns than one would hope. Even though that number sounds quite small, the 135 that we received back is pretty standard for this type of research. We sent the surveys to a cross-section of AAN members, so that's the American Academy of Neurology, in the U.S. specifically. It was done in such a way where we got a proportional aspect of practice locations, so throughout the entire United States. It wasn't concentrated on the coasts, for example, or in large cities. We also got a nice cross-section of ages and different practice settings, so private practice versus academics, and then different specialties. And so it was a really nice broad swath that's representative of neurologists in general.
And could you characterize some of the basic findings you got from the respondents?
Sure. So the vast majority of respondents felt comfortable examining and taking history from lesbian, gay, and bisexual patients. Slightly less with transgender patients, but not statistically significant. So overall, pretty comfortable, pretty high levels of reported abilities to conduct sort of the basics of the medical encounter, if you will. But when we ask questions that directly queried the knowledge base of those neurologists on specific health topics, some of the examples that I provided just a moment ago about, for example, gender-affirming hormones and anti-epileptic drugs, fewer physicians actually got these answers correct. And so what we observed was a gap between comfort level and perceived knowledge base and actual knowledge base, which to us was not entirely surprising, but it gave us some hard data to suggest that additional cultural competency training would be of benefit to neurologists in general. And really, for me, the most heartening piece of this was that we asked neurologists if they were interested in learning more or if they had actually learned something by taking the survey, because we, for example, provided definitions of what some of the terminology means. So, for example, what transgender means, et cetera, et cetera. And many of the respondents answered that they did learn something from taking the survey and were very open to learning more. So we felt encouraged by that result.
That would be an encouraging sign. I can see that, yeah. The cultural competency part of this, though, I'm delving a little further into the medical training here now, because you said the education was really poor even for you 15 years ago in medical school. Is it because medical schools really want to make sure they're dealing with the bodies of people and trying not to get into the other stuff about their lives?
Well, I don't think that's quite the case. I think there was just a lack of awareness that falling somewhere within this LGBTQI umbrella directly impacts health status. And we know that this identity and as well as orientation is a social determinant of health, which is absolutely key, not unlike a condition such as poverty. So not to say the two are the same, very different, but it really is important for physicians to have a good grasp on how these particular issues intersect and impact the health of the patients they're taking care of so that they can provide the highest quality care possible.
You mentioned that of the surveys you got back that you sent out to 1,000 neurologists, got back 135, pretty good return actually, that generally okay with lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, a little less comfortable in providing care. You've designed, haven't you, an educational program at OHSU. There is a transgender health program there, right?
We are very fortunate to have a transgender center of excellence at OHSU, which is I'm not directly involved with, but my colleagues certainly are, and they provide an amazing services that are comprehensive. So if patients are looking for gender reassignment, gender-affirming hormones, and all of the ancillary services that go along with that, OHSU does an outstanding job in that arena. So that's really wonderful. What I focus my attention on is that not necessarily every city or program or private practice is leads such a sort of charmed life that we do in Portland. And so what we had really concentrated on is providing cultural competency education for a broad swath of our national audience. And so what we do is we provide an educational course at our annual meeting at the American Academy of Neurology for any provider, not just neurologists, but also advanced practice providers and any ancillary health staff that attend that meeting that are interested in learning more about this patient population, getting familiar with terminology, understanding a few of the aspects that I mentioned about how this directly impacts neurologic health. And then also we go over some key aspects of making one's clinic open and welcoming to this patient population and being thoughtful, for example, about brochures and material and the types of folks that are depicted in that literature. And so we have a lot of practical tips for our practicing neurologists on how to ensure that this patient population feels welcome, comfortable, because that type of bond with their physician, with their provider, really encourages open, honest communication, and that really forms the foundation of an excellent encounter and really high quality healthcare.
So if doctor and patient trust each other, they do a little better job in getting some healthcare achieved.
It sounds obvious, but it's really key.
And how well attended, I wonder, Dr. Hansen, is the presentation at the AAN annual meeting?
Well, we typically have on the order of 50 to 75 attendees, and this is the second time that we've offered this course at our annual meeting. A lot of folks come up to us after the course and have a lot of positive, warm things to say, thanking us that this was not something that they necessarily were able to attend in their particular medical school or had exposure to during their residency. And we've noticed physicians really from all over the country attending these programs. And so the reception has been very, very positive. We're hopeful to continue to spread the word. Not every single neurologist is able to attend the annual meeting every single year. And so we're hopeful that over the course of several years that we're going to continue to expand the audience and get the word out.
Okay, a chance for people who are involved in the field of neurology to know more about dealing with SGM patients, patients of sexual and gender minorities, with obviously some things to deal with there, some conflicts in medication, for example. Dr. Holly Hinson is Associate Professor of Neurology at the OHSU School of Medicine. Thank you for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.